American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Visit us online at ashp.cuny.edu. In part one of this podcast, Pramila Nadison of Queens College, City University of New York, offers New York City teachers a critique of the traditional civil rights narrative. This talk took place on April 22, 2010, at the Graduate Center.
The civil rights movement raises fundamental questions, I think, about how social change occurs. Scholars who are writing about the civil rights movement have examined the impact of ordinary people on shaping the world around them. In the 1960s, ordinary people, people who were teachers, who were domestic workers, who were welfare recipients, who were farm workers, had a profound influence on things like government, how government operates, on the boundaries of political discourse, on legislation and court decisions, and I think on the very meaning of political participation. Okay? These were not judges, they were not lawyers, they were not politicians or the heads of corporations. And I think when we think about it in that light, it's quite astounding the degree to which relatively powerless people were able to affect social change. So I think you're absolutely correct in terms of thinking about how the civil rights movement offers a model or a lesson for other discriminated or oppressed groups in this country. So the 1960s offers insight in thinking about how American history unfolds, but also how people can empower themselves and shape the world around them. So it's not just a lesson in change over time, it's not just a lesson in overcoming racial barriers, but I think it's also a lesson for your students that what they do matters, right? And that the choices that they make often can and do make a difference. Over the past 20 years, there's been quite a lot that's been published on the history of the civil rights movement. There have been a number of local studies that have looked at communities, Durham, North Carolina, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Oakland, California, Birmingham, Alabama. There have been a number of biographies that have been published, organizational histories. These new studies have not only given us a more textured view of the civil rights movement, but they've helped us rethink some of the very basic assumptions about the civil rights movement. And these, and this is reflected in a shift in language. A lot of scholars, people like Clay Carson, Robin Kelly, and Vincent Harding, have argued that we shouldn't be using the term civil rights movement any longer. They've suggested that we use the term the Black Freedom Movement. And I want to ask you, what does that reflect to you? Why do you think that might be significant? What are they trying to tell us when they're suggesting that we move away from the civil rights movement towards calling this the Black Freedom Movement? Okay, so civil rights movement implies top down, right? Implies the power of government officials, whereas bottom up, whereas Black Freedom implies a movement among ordinary people. If we talk about civil rights, we could be talking about gay or lesbians, we could be talking about the women's movement, we could be talking about the Mexican-American movement, right? In some ways, it's a much broader term, right? Whereas Black Freedom Movement refers specifically to the African-American struggle for freedom. Let's talk for a moment about the traditional timeline associated with the civil rights movement. And I know you talked a little bit about the Montgomery bus boycott this morning, right? The traditional narrative associated with the civil rights movement, and I'm talking specifically about African American history here, and I think your point is a very good one about how civil rights could be applied to many other groups as well. But in terms of the African American political struggle, that narrative of the civil rights movement usually begins in 1955. If you pick up almost any textbook, right, it will say the civil rights movement began in 1955 with Montgomery. Montgomery was the first successful mass boycott. As you know, tens of thousands of people participated in it. Montgomery leads to a court decision after about a year, a court decision that outlaws segregation on public transportation in Montgomery. It also propels important leaders such as Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy into the national spotlight, right? So the Montgomery bus boycott is actually considered a very pivotal moment in the history of the civil rights movement. And this early period, the late 50s to the early 60s, is considered really the golden age of the civil rights movement, right? A period of racial harmony, a period of a unified political movement. It also spawns other political movements, right? There were students who organized in this period. There were women who organized. There was an anti-poverty movement that emerged. And many of the traditional histories suggest that these movements emerge out of the civil rights movement, right? One example you might know of are two women, Mary King and Casey Hayden, who were involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, became very disgruntled and upset with the sexism in the movement, wrote a position paper on it, and eventually went on to form what we now know as a radical wing of the women's movement, right? Tom Hayden, who founded Students for a Democratic Society, he was first involved in the civil rights movement in the Deep South. So this early period of the civil rights movement, I think in many ways is considered the model of organizing, the model of social change. Yes, this is not my narrative. This is the narrative we read in many textbooks. And my point ultimately is going to be that there are so many pieces that don't fit into this narrative. Okay, that's the point I'm gonna make right now. It is absolutely a big piece, and that's why I think we kind of need to discard this understanding of the civil rights movement. Because Malcolm X, and not just Malcolm X, there are dozens of other organizations and individuals who don't fit this model. The Black Panthers? Well, in some ways they fit better than Malcolm X does. So let's move on to the radicalization. So this traditional narrative, not my narrative, this traditional narrative suggests that in the mid-1960s, in 1965 and 1966, there's a radicalization of the movement, okay? That organizations such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Congress of Racial Equality, do you guys know those organizations? I'm using those, okay. The Congress of Racial Equality, for example, both expel their white participants, right? They turn to Black power. They become much more militant in their ideology and in their practice. They begin to call for self-defense, right? Moving away from nonviolence, and they begin to address economic issues. There's a shift away from seeing the South as a primary problem in terms of race and thinking about race or racism as a national problem. The term Black Power was first used by Stokely Carmichael at a march in 1966, the Meredith March. Now, why do you think this radicalization occurred? And this is something I'm sure you've probably taught, right? Why? Why is there this shift in 65, 66, away from the nonviolent, multiracial organizing that characterized the earlier period towards this Black Power, armed self-defense, phase of the movement? Yes? Absolutely. I think the passage of the both acts, the 64 Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, were absolutely critical in terms of how and why people began to shift their thinking. If you think about it, in the mid-1960s, there were a number of urban riots around the country, right? Harlem in 1964, Philadelphia in 1964, Watts in 1965, Newark and Detroit in 1967, right? And that alerted many civil rights activists and organizations that, hey, despite the passage of these two landmark laws, right, there's a lot of discontent in the inner city among African Americans. So it forced people to think about the more intractable problems of poverty, right? And to realize that these laws, while important, are not going to address those more deep-seated issues. But in addition to that, There was a tremendous amount of violence that civil rights activists in the South faced, nonviolent civil rights activists, right? And you all know about the three civil rights workers who were killed in Mississippi in 1964. They are just a few of them. In addition, there was Medgar Evers, Viola Luisa, who was a White Housewife from Detroit, James Reeb, Herbert Lee, and the list goes on and on. There were a lot of nonviolent civil rights activists who were murdered or beaten. And so this relentless violence led many civil rights activists to become very disillusioned with the strategy of nonviolence. This traditional narrative, okay, usually ends around 1968. Why 68? That was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? It was the year that Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Okay. Many people view the later period of the civil rights movement as one in which, especially after 66, when there's a real splintering among social activists, right? Their offshoots was the formation of the Black Panther Party. SNCC becomes much narrower in terms of the kinds of work it's doing. And many people argue that there's, in fact, a polarization, the erosion of the middle ground, and a polarization between people on the left and people on the right, which leads ultimately to the election of Richard Nixon in 1968.
In 1968, we had the Ocean Hill-Brownsville strike here, which became very racially polarized and began to have anti-Semitic overtones, which led to splitting, at least in New York, of the liberal Jewish contribution to the civil rights movement began to pull away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that's one of the arguments about how and why there's a splintering. Race becomes much more, again, it's this argument about black power, right, about racial identity, a move away from this idea or this notion of a multiracial alliance towards racial equality, right, but racial identity becomes much more important, especially for African Americans, the idea of black power, the idea of black-run schools, things like that. So you're absolutely right, that's one argument that's made about how and why we see the splintering in these divisions and the erosion of a unified movement. Now, I think as the gentleman in the back said, I think this this traditional narrative is flawed in so many ways, right? Malcolm X is certainly one piece that does not fit very well into this traditional narrative. And the shift towards the term, the Black Power movement, okay, has emerged because historians have tried to grapple with the weaknesses of the traditional narrative. The new chronology that they propose suggests that there is, in fact, a long civil rights movement, and I think you talked about this term this morning, right? A long civil rights movement didn't begin in 1955. In fact, as you probably know, Montgomery was not the first bus boycott, right? The first bus boycott in the post-war period occurred in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I think I have a photograph here. This is a photograph from Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1953, where local activists began to organize a bus boycott in order to challenge segregated seating on the city buses. The city council, the boycott lasted for 8 days before the city council agreed to open seating except for the first and last rows. The first row was reserved for whites and the last row was reserved for blacks. So clearly there were other protests, there were other boycotts in the post-war period. But scholars have also looked not just at the roots of civil rights protests or black freedom struggle protests in the early 50s, but have gone all the way back to the 1930s and the 1940s, suggesting that the real roots of the civil rights movement lay in that period of social protest of the 1930s. Just one example of this is Ella Baker. How many of you have heard of Ella Baker? Ella Baker was an important activist from the 1930s all the way through the 1970s. And she was a link between the earlier and the later generation of activists. Baker was involved in community organizing in Harlem during the Great Depression. And she brought this experience with her to the Civil Rights Movement, where she served as executive director of King's organization, SCLC, in the 1950s. And she was also an advisor to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which initiated the sit-ins in 1960. As her biographer Barbara Ransby puts it, Ella Baker was one of the most important behind-the-scenes activists in this period. Again, drawing that link between the 1930s and the 1950s has become very important in thinking about the roots of the civil rights movement. The new chronology of the Black Freedom Movement suggests that 1968 was not an end. Right? That in fact there was a tremendous amount of political activity that occurred in the 1970s. Okay? There were community organizations that organized around welfare rights, around health care, around public health, around wages. So scholars are increasingly looking at that political activity. 1973 was when the National Black Feminist Organization was formed. And Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 1972. Her election was extremely important in mobilizing communities around the country. So we have to, I think, look a little further and to think about ways in which political activism didn't end in 1968, but actually continued beyond that. The Black Freedom Movement also suggests a new geography, okay? If the traditional narrative suggests that the civil rights movement begins in the South and after 1966 begins to focus on the North, okay, the Black Freedom Movement suggests, well, actually there was organizing that was occurring throughout the country in the 1950s and the 1960s. And I'll talk about this when I talk about the welfare rights movement in a few moments. So it sees the political struggle as national rather than regional. The Black Freedom Movement narrative also presents us with a new meaning of freedom. Okay? I think the civil rights movement suggests a campaign for formal legal equality, right? For legal rights, for civil rights. Right? There were many organizations in this period that were not only focused on civil rights. They were engaged in issues of housing, economic justice, health care, anti-war, welfare rights. And so I think to truly understand the nature of political activity in this period, we have to broaden our lens to think about the multiple issues that people were involved in. It also suggests that clear or strict dichotomy that we see between the nonviolent Southern-based movement led by King and the struggle for self-defense that was waged by the Black Panther Party in places like Oakland was not actually accurate. Okay, that even in the earlier period, there were activists who advocated armed self-defense. Robert Williams, who you might have heard about, Robert Williams was an NAACP activist who lived in North Carolina. And he, from a very early period, advocated armed self-defense. Gloria Richardson is another one. I think you have a photograph of her in your packet. I also have it up here. This is Gloria Richardson, who was the head of the Nonviolent Action Committee in Cambridge, Maryland. And despite the name of the organization, Gloria Richardson was not purely nonviolent. She advocated armed self-defense. Both Richardson and Williams were not committed to nonviolence as a philosophy, but rather as a tactic. People like Williams and others were engaged in nonviolent protests, but they were living in the midst of a very violent, racist Southern society. And sometimes they saw violence as the only appropriate response. Right, as a measure of self-defense. So for them, as Tim Tyson, who's a biographer of Williams, has said, for them, violence and nonviolence worked in tandem. So this new scholarship that's emerged over the past 20 years suggests that the Black Freedom Movement was a lot messier and a lot more complicated than a very simple linear model would lead us to believe. I think that traditional narrative of the civil rights movement is not inaccurate, okay, but it is narrow. It really developed out of an understanding of the political evolution of key political players, national leaders in particular. Mainly around Martin Luther King, right? King, we know, became radicalized in 1966. He took a position against the war in Vietnam, which was a big struggle for him, in 67. At the moment of his death, he was in Memphis, Tennessee, organizing sanitation workers. So he himself had come to see the importance of looking at race in national terms, had come to a place where he began to see the importance of dealing with economic issues. SCLC, his organization, started a program called Operation Breadbasket in Chicago in 1966, headed by Jesse Jackson, and he launched there a "Don't Buy Where You Can't Work" campaign. Again, thinking about economic issues and how to empower the black community in Chicago. And I think SNCC and CORE are also part of this trajectory, the radicalization in the mid 60s. So I think the traditional narrative is really a reflection, if I can say so, of a great man view of history, right? So even though we talk about and understand the civil rights movement as mass-based, as evidence of power of the people, much of the framing of the civil rights movement has often occurred around the work of very identifiable and well-known male leaders, people like Martin Luther King, A. Philip Randolph, Stokely Carmichael, and Huey Newton. They have, to a large degree, shaped that narrative. So I think that the shift away from civil rights towards black freedom also enriches our understanding of the role of gender in the civil rights movement. There were literally thousands of women who were involved in the civil rights movement, and many of them provided very important leadership roles. Women like Ella Baker, Johnny Tillman, Septima Clark, Diane Nash, Gloria Richardson, Assata Shakur. How many of you use those names in your classrooms? There's still not enough, but there is some literature about them and about their role in the civil rights movement. And I want to talk in particular about two influential scholars who have written about the role of women in the civil rights movement. And I think their books are on the bibliography that you have. One is Charles Payne, who wrote a book called I've Got the Light of Freedom about the civil rights movement in Mississippi. Payne also wrote an article which he titled Men Led But Women Organized. And Charles Payne argues that we need a more complex picture of the civil rights movement. That yes, we do see men in these very important leadership roles. The men were the ministers, after all, right? But he asks us, well, who were the church members? It was the women, right? So if you're talking about a church-based Southern civil rights movement, he suggests we have to look at the role of women in the church and the role they played in carrying out the work of organizing. So men might have been at the podium, but women were doing the organizing work, the day-to-day organizing work. And we can see this in Montgomery as well, right? In the Montgomery bus boycott, King was the head of the Montgomery Improvement Association. He was a reverend, had a very respected position in the black community. But a lot of the organizing, who Xeroxed the leaflets? Who created the leaflets? Who handed out the leaflets, right? Who were the ones who decided not to take the bus and to walk to work? Okay, it was largely women. Women were the base of the Montgomery bus boycott, and women were the ones who made it happen. And I think you spoke about that already today. The other author I want to talk about is Belinda Robnett, who wrote a book on women in the civil rights movement and argues, and she came up with this term, argues that women were bridge leaders, okay, who were community leaders who were essential to the success of any community organizing in the South. So a bridge leader is somebody who connects local communities to the national organization, okay? So SCLC, SNCC, and CORE, she argues, would not have been able to carry out their voter education projects or to mobilize communities for protests or marches without the help of these influential community women. These were women who housed the civil rights activists, who told them who to speak to, who told them when and where to have their meetings. I think both Payne and Robnett have made extremely important contributions to our understanding of the civil rights movement. They both acknowledge the work that women have done that's been invisible, that's been unrecognized, and that's been behind the scenes, but they both see women as supporters, as the grassroots base. And I don't want to diminish this. I think it's important to give credit where credit is due. But I also think there's some new emerging perspectives on the role of women in the civil rights movement that might make us think differently. And that is, I would argue that women were not just supporters. They were not just behind-the-scenes activists, but they were leaders, intellectuals, and theorists in their own right. So we shouldn't be asking, how did women contribute to the civil rights movement? We should be asking, how did women's participation change the meaning of black freedom? And I want to turn to the welfare rights movement to help us think about some of these issues.